delegate types know her because she's been the General Service Conference Coordinator for the last 2 years. That sounds like a pretty big job right there. Probably the biggest job that she's done, though, for AA has been to coordinate the International Convention in New Orleans. And all y'all that were there know how well that went. So she does have a good program going for her, I'd say. She's been here a few 24 hours, and it was nice this morning that she was sharing that she's still working on her ego, something I have to work on every day. So I think that's really what gives us our unity, like this theme, is that we're all working along the same lines on the same things. I'd like you to help me welcome Betty L. from Brooklyn, New York.
Thank you very much, Lisa. My name is Betty Little, and I'm an alcoholic. And it has been a delight to meet Lisa. She demonstrates to me that the future of the fellowship is in very good hands. I also have met some other very wonderful people right from the time I stepped off the plane. Peggy and Eugenia were there to meet me, and to see to it that I got over here and everything was all right. And of course I've met many old friends and your past delegates, and it's indeed a great pleasure for me to be here in the state of Georgia for your 29th, is it, annual AA convention. I am Betty, and I do live in Brooklyn now. I was born in the Bronx. I didn't take too much of a geographical, you can see. I come from a Bronx Irish Catholic family. Eat your heart out, Elkie. And when I came to AA, they told me that I didn't have to be an Irish Catholic to join this group, but that it would help. My family moved to Long Island when I was an infant, and that's where I was brought up, in a small middle-class community. My family were good people. Irish Catholic and neurotic, of course, but good people. And I can't say that I was the victim of neglect or any of that sort of thing that some people are. My parents' their greatest error was overprotection. I had the classic alcoholic family, the passive and quiet father and the dominant mother. And my mother was terrified of alcohol. Her father had a different personality when he drank, so I don't think he was an alcoholic. And my father's father had died of alcoholism in Bellevue Hospital before I was born and before this fellowship came into being. So she was very afraid of alcohol. She was afraid of what it could do. And when I was 9 years old, she forbade me to drink. Now, I hadn't even thought of it yet. But she just said, you must never drink. Well, of course, I already had the personality of an alcoholic at that time, and so I became fascinated by the whole idea. And I contained myself until I was 14 when I had my first drink. The only thing I have to report about it is that I liked the taste of it, the smell of it, and most of all, I liked the way it made me feel. When I was 14 years old, I was as tall as I am now, and I weighed a little more than I do now, considerably more than I do now. Needless to say, my social calendar wasn't excessively filled. I was a compulsive eater as a child, which was perhaps one of the first signposts of my disease. And so, because of this very overprotective family, I didn't get into a great deal of trouble in my teens, except for the fact that at every opportunity that came along, I would drink. And it became evident to my friends early on that I had a capacity to hold my liquor better than most of them did. And in my youth, I was the one who always drove the cars home and held the other heads over the toilet bowl. As time passed, however, and I got further and further into excessive drinking and drinking large quantities, I lost this capacity. it took less and less alcohol as time went on for me to be drunk, and more alcohol for me to feel comfortable. And by the time I came to AA, I was hanging on to sanity like it was a fine thread, because there was only a few moments in the course of an evening's drinking where I was comfortable and not drunk and out of control. Of course, getting to that point was a long and arduous road. I graduated from high school and went to business school, and then went into New York City, as all young women who lived in the suburbs did, to begin what was supposed to have been a business career. And I was then about 16, 17 years old. I quickly found out about the lunchtime cocktail, and I liked that. And I found out about bars, and I liked them too. And I liked the bottles and the mirrors and the nice men in the big white aprons who gave you the drinks. And I quickly found out that if you drank at the bar, you got a stronger drink than you did if you were sitting back in the cocktail lounge. And so I disposed of the cocktail lounge rather rapidly. When I was 22, I went away on a vacation in the Pocono Mountains, and that's what you did in those days. And I went to a place called Split Rock Lodge, and there was a woman at our table who I started to kind of buddy up with. And the first night there, we took up with some local gentlemen that we met at the bar, and ended up at an after-hours place, and we were drinking all evening. And at least I was drinking all night. What I didn't notice was that she was a person who stopped drinking alcohol after the first two or three drinks and switched to some innocuous beverage like ginger ale or something like that. However, she did notice that I liked to drink, and we had a very good time at this place. But when we returned, it turned out that we both worked in Rockefeller Center in New York, and she said to me, "I know of a bar in New York that I think you might like." And so when we returned one Friday evening, I met her for dinner, and we went to this bar. And I liked it so much that about 2 years later, or 7 years later, whatever, I was getting mail there, telephone calls there. And it was, for me, a home away from home. Many years later, when I was in AA, she told me that she felt great guilt about this, because I became a regular in that bar, which she did not, because she wasn't an alcoholic and drinking was not the central force in her life, and it was in mine, because I was an alcoholic. And of course, I relieved her of any guilt. I said if it hadn't been that bar, it would have been another one. I was still living at that time at home with this overprotective family. And at that time, there were other forces in my life. I was still young. And when I was 11 years old, I can remember becoming involved with a group of people known as the Save the Children Federation. And I would go around and knock on doors and collect clothing for the poor children in the South. I don't know why we were always told that all the poor children were in the South, but I'm really pleased to be here tonight and this afternoon and see that some of you transcended the poverty, you know. But at any rate, I was involved with this sort of thing and interested in this sort of thing when I was a child. I was also very active in the Girl Scouts and in activities like that. I became active in my early 20s in the Junior Women's Club in Floyd Park, and then the Federation of Women's Clubs on Long Island. And I would have to get up and lead meetings, and I would be overcome with anxiety. And there I'd be with my hat, you know, and everything, chairing these meetings. And I quickly found out after my introduction to alcohol that if I had a few drinks before I led these meetings, or I had to get up and give a report, that I was able to do it a great deal better. At least I thought I was able to do it a great deal better. Pretty soon, the alcohol became the central force, and I said, to hell with the Junior Women's Club, and so much for that. The weight shifted entirely over to drinking and drinking activities and drinking friends. I worked for many years in an advertising agency, and I think I was working there when I began drinking in the bar. And pretty soon it was lunchtime at the bar as well as evening at the bar. And there were many people in advertising and publishing who drank there. And one lunchtime, the man sitting next to me, who I knew, who worked for Newsweek magazine, said his boss's secretary had committed suicide over the weekend. And so I went out and bought a hat and applied for the job. And that was sort of the way I did things. Other people, when they wanted a new job, did things through the New York Times. I responded to the big information that I got at the bar. And I got the job. But I was at that time 26, 27 years old, something like that. And I was totally dependent on alcohol to go on the job interview. I was by that time a daily drinker. By that time it was evident that my ability to form relationships, particularly with the opposite sex, was totally dependent on alcohol. Therefore, I really didn't form relationships because I was totally involved with myself, which is, and my anxieties and my ill at ease-ness, which is, again, a signpost of alcoholism, which I was incapable of recognizing at that time. And so I went along on my merry way and I got this job, and there were all kinds of opportunities to drink there. I supervised the secretaries of all the space salesmen at Newsweek magazine. And there were 14 space salesmen and 7 secretaries. And very quickly, with alcoholic expertise, I organized the department so that all these girls did all my work, you see. I would call meetings. I would put that hat on I had left over from the Junior Women's Club and call a meeting in the morning, just like the boss did with the salesmen. And then I delegated responsibility. And actually, in fact, I got the department running better than it had been in years. But once having done that, I would go to lunch, you see. And unfortunately, the man that I was working for also went to lunch for elongated periods of time. And I don't want to take his inventory, but he certainly seemed to be suffering from the same disease I was, only more so. And what he needed was a secretary who was going to be there to cover his tracks when he wasn't there. And so 2 years later, I was fired from that job. And it was the first of 7 jobs that I was fired from as a result of the use and abuse of alcohol. And they would say to me, you know, we really had high hopes for you, because when I would get a new job, you know, I would shape up and I would say, well, I'm only going to drink on weekends, or I won't drink when I have to be at a meeting in the morning, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. And I made all kinds of concessions about my drinking within my head. I always broke these rules I set up for myself. With one bartender, I used to say, don't let me drink more than 2 dry Manhattans. Insist that I switch over to Ryan soda after that, or Ryan water. And of course, then when he would try and enforce the rule that I had asked him to enforce on me, I would argue and fight with him and drink too many dry Manhattans and once again not be able to get up in the morning. In retrospect, more and more, I can see myself as a victim of alcoholism. I can see alcoholism as a disease, and I can see how my life was totally controlled by it. From the time I picked up that first drink when I was 14 years old, I stopped developing emotionally because I was totally ruled by alcohol. And I think that I stayed at whatever stage of emotional development I had achieved by the time I was 14 years old, until the day I came into this program when I was 34 years old. It went on and it got worse. With each job that I lost, the next one was lesser and lesser and lesser. And I had less and less ability to hold myself together, to put myself together, to look respectable when I went to work in the morning. I was gaining more and more and more weight. My face was bloated and blotchy. My eyes were, you know, road maps. I can remember in the ad agency going back to get my coffee in the art department one morning, and one of the artists looked up and said, is that the route from Akron to Toledo? It had its funny spots, but basically it was tragic. At some point along the line, I used to go home to my parents on weekends, you know, and I treated my parents' home like a filling station. Because I filled up. I ate proper food and I did a lot of sleeping. My mother couldn't understand why I was always so tired when I would come home. And I would rest up and go back to New York to do battle once again. And it went on and on. At some point when I went home, I was then about 30 years old, and I was in very poor physical condition, or 31 years old, something like that. My sister told me that my mother was being admitted to the hospital, and we knew that there had been something wrong. And after the operation, we were told that my mother, they just closed her up. She had incurable cancer. And by this time, my incurable alcoholism had developed to the degree that I really was unable to manage my life. The gas and electric had been, the telephone would be shut off and I'd get it put on again. And I would borrow money and get put out of apartments and all of this sort of thing. And so when I learned that my mother was not going to recover from alcoholism, from cancer, I volunteered to go home and take care of her. I gave up the struggle and gave up the apartment and volunteered to go home and care for my mother until her death. Today I understand that in fact I was going home to be taken care of, because I seem to have lost the ability to look after myself. And so I was able to go home and move back into their household and care for her physically until her death and take care of the house. On the few occasions that my sister would come and stay there, I would go into New York and get drunk. It was the only thing I knew how to do. I didn't know how to have a good time without drinking, and I didn't know how to drink without getting drunk. And then I would return and resume this task of looking after my mother. She died in 1961. And I broke up their home, and I cared for my father for about 18 months. And my father began to drink with me because I wasn't afraid of him. And while I cared for her, I had hidden my bottle. And I would just sneak drinks from time to time because I told you, see, it was a matriarchal home. And when she died, I took the bottle that was hidden out from under the sink and put it on top of the sink and suggested to my father that we have a little drink before dinner. And he agreed very, very readily. And within a short period of time, my father was drinking a fifth of booze a day. The doctor had recommended, he was not well, and the doctor had recommended a little drink for him to improve his circulation. But he did not mean every 10 minutes. Pretty soon his condition deteriorated, and after about 14 or 18 months of this, he was put in a nursing home, and I was left to break up their home. And I did this. It took me an awful long time. I think I took 2 weeks off from work. I know I was drunk most of the time. I know I was drunk when the Salvation Army came and I gave away what winter coats I had. They weren't in very good condition, but I gave away these winter coats because there was a certain stage in drinking, you know, and I knew that everything was going to be all right tomorrow. You know that stage when you've had 4 or 5 drinks and you can't understand what you were worrying about this morning because you're so smart and you're so lovable that everything is going to work out all right, you see. Well, the Salvation Army arrived at that point in my drinking that day, and I said, take these coats and give them to the poor. And they did that. And so I entered Alcoholics Anonymous in April, fortunately. But when winter came, and up north it gets cold in the winter, when winter came I was without a winter coat. Needless to say, I survived it with the good offices of the friends I'd made in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I broke up their home and moved into a furnished room in a place called Massapequa, Long Island. The friends that I'd had since childhood had sort of given up spending very much time with me because I would pass out on their sofa, and I was very hard to move when I passed out. And it just, it was like, we love her, but, you know. And so I was invited to less and less dinner parties and less occasions where alcohol was served at all. And so I spent the last year or year and a half of my drinking in this furnished room in Massapequa. And in October of 1962, I woke up one morning in that furnished room and said aloud what I believe today to be the first honest prayer I ever said in my life. And it was simply, my God, get me out of here. I was experiencing a desperation that I believe I don't have to explain to most people who are in this room this afternoon. Because if you understand it, I don't have to explain it to you, and if you don't, I can't. It was a desperation that I felt down to my socks. I wanted God to get me out of my own skin, out of the life, out of the way I was living. And I believe that he answered that prayer on that day. It was simply, my God, get me out of here. I picked up the paper, and there was an advertisement for a job in Huntington, Long Island. And by now I was doing temporary jobs. You know, you'd get $21 for 3 days' work or whatever it was. And I wouldn't know whether to buy booze or pills, because I was also into tranquilizers that a doctor had prescribed for me some 5 or 6 years earlier that I was totally hooked on. The first tranquilizer that I was given was a thing called Desbutol. Desbutol pets you up and calms you down simultaneously. And the result was that you could cross the street against the light and not worry. I took those for years, but pretty soon the Dexedrine in them made me so nervous I stopped taking them, and I moved on to things like Milltown and Equinol, and it was before I think you could get Librium then, and that sort of thing. And I was as hooked on that stuff now as I was on booze. And so when I would get the $7 that I got from the temporary job, so the $21 or the $28, I was always torn as to whether to buy the vodka or the pills. And in those days, they weren't as worried about addictive drugs as they are today. And the FDA hadn't put all the restrictions on the druggists that they have today. And it was possible, if you were a smart girl like I was, to get one prescription operative in 3 different drugstores. And that's what I would do, so that I was never, you know, I might run out of credit. You could also get credit in drugstores. So if you had it running in 3 different drugstores, you were always safe. And that's what I would do. At any rate, on that day, and I also had a car that was in the same state of disrepair that I was. And this particular car, you started by spraying ether on the carburetor in the summer. And so on this particular day, I saw this ad, and I got an appointment for an interview. And I had a can of tuna fish and a vodka Miltini, which meant Milltown, and a vodka martini. I went to the closet and chose from the 2 dresses. One was a black dress with splits in the seam, and the other was a navy blue or brown one with a cigarette hole in it. And I opted for the cigarette hole, and I put on over it a gray cashmere coat. It was in October, and I put on a gray cashmere coat that I had worn when I was working for Newsweek at the Women's Ad Club ball, and it was still in pretty good condition. I said, this will cover the cigarette hole, and the brown looks better. And I went out to the car, sprayed the ether on the carburetor, jumped in, and away I went. The appointment was for something like 3 p.m. And right as I went out the door, I received a phone call on the landlord's phone from a gentleman of my acquaintance who invited me for a drink after the interview. I got there, and I sat. It was one of these industrial parks with the glass fronts, you know. And I signed the register, and I sat in the reception room with the receptionist for over an hour waiting for this man to see me. And many times within that hour, I wanted to flee because the vodka was wearing off. And the sun was setting, and it was coming through the glass, and it was getting hot in that reception room, and I couldn't take the coat off because the cigarette hole would show. And of course, my eyes had that road map, that route from Akron to Toledo in them. And the receptionist also smelled my breath when I signed the register. And unbeknownst to me, God was working one of his anonymous miracles or coincidences on that afternoon, because the receptionist in that office was 2 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by some miracle, the man finally came out at 4 o'clock, and he felt so guilty for keeping me waiting so long, he gave me the job. The organization that owned this company also owned the New York Mets, and this was in 1962. I don't remember if you know what the New York Mets were doing in 1962, but it wasn't good. And neither was this organization, because they hired me, you know. And I became friends with that woman, Dorothy. And Dorothy would go home at night and say to her husband, "What'll I do if they fire her before I get her?" And Bill would say, "Dorothy, it's a program of attraction, not promotion." I would call in the morning, sometimes I'd still be drunk. And she would say, "Hang up and I'll take care of this, and don't call back until tomorrow. I'll call you later." And then she'd tell my boss, after he hung up from a phone call, that I had called while he was busy on another line and that I was ill. She would call me back and see if she could get me through to stay sober through the day and get me to work the next day. And finally, some 6 months later, Dorothy and Bill invited me to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Manhasset with them on a Thursday evening. And in that 6 months, she was very kind to me. By now, my father was in a nursing home, and I had moved out of the furnished room in Massapequa, and I was living in a little attic apartment in Huntington. In some ways, my life had gotten slightly better. I had a full-time job. There were people that I spoke to each day in my life, though I didn't do much else. It was 2 miles from the apartment to the job, and there was a liquor store and a grocery store in between, and I still ate as much as I drank, which was why I weighed so much when it came to AA. But Dorothy was always kind to me. If I didn't have money, like maybe a night before payday, she'd say, "Here, borrow $5, go buy your father some chocolates and go to see him in the nursing home." But she'd never give me enough money so that I could get in trouble with it. She'd give me just enough money so I could get the gas to go into the nursing home and buy him something on the way. She was one of the kindest people I ever met. And she and Bill took me to the meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in Manhasset. Now, what you have to understand is that Manhasset, it's the Gold Coast of Long Island. It's on the North Shore, and any of you that are familiar with Long Island would understand. And there were Cadillacs in the parking lot, and the women wore mink stoles in April, and they had alligator shoes with pocketbooks that matched. And I thought that was the living end. And I arrived trying to get the runs in my stockings on straight in one of the two dirty black or brown dresses, not having washed my hair in a couple of weeks, because it was a lot of trouble to me to do those things. I just went home from work and drank as much as I had available and fell asleep a sodden mess day after day, night after night. And I walked into the Manhasset group like this, and a woman who came from what I still call old money walked up to me and said, "My dear, are you a new member?" And I stood my full height and said to her, "I'm considering." Because I was not about to sign anything. And she said, "Darling, come with me. We have a special row for considerers." And she took me up to the second row, and by some miracle, in Manhasset, Long Island on that night, they had speakers from New York City. And they had a man whose name was Jim, and I remember he was very attractive. And he was an older man, but very attractive. And the woman was a woman probably about my age now, and she looked lovely. And she told my story. She told the story of the beginnings of an excellent business career and of failing at it. And she said that this man had called her up. She looked grand, and he had called her up at 3 o'clock that afternoon, and he had invited her to go to dinner and speak at this meeting that night. And now, if I was going to look anywhere near the way that lady looked, I needed 3 weeks' notice at that point, you see. But here she was on short notice, looking just grand, in her hair in place and lovely clothing. And I listened to her tell her story, and she sounded very happy, and I knew that she had a good life. And she talked about going into a liquor store during her drinking days and walking up and down in front of the wine rack, trying to figure out the bottle of wine for the least money with the highest alcohol content. And then taking that bottle and bringing it to the counter and saying to the man, "Is this the proper wine with chicken?" And I had done exactly that the week before. Maybe I said veal, I don't know. But I had done precisely that. It's high mathematics when you have a hangover. And so for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified with what she said. I left there that night, and Dorothy and Bill drove me home, and they said, "Are you going to drink tonight?" And I said, "No." It was Thursday, but I thought to myself, tomorrow's Friday, and I'll get paid, and I'll drink then. Well, Friday came, and at 9:30 in the morning, there was a call from a bill collector who had a judgment against me for one of the many bills that I owed. I had no telephone when I came to that end, because the phone had gone out long ago. And this man had a judgment. I don't remember which bill it was. And he had already spoken to my boss, and my boss had already told me that if he put the judgment through, that I was fired, that they didn't want to be annoyed with the bookkeeping of going to cheap salaries. And if I was fired, I was out of the apartment I was now in because I was paying the rent by the week. I could not accumulate $90 in a month because I lived hand to mouth. So I paid the man $19.20 a week. For you accountants, that comes up to $90 a month. So he had told me if I missed 1 week, I was out. And I would be sleeping in the car with a can of ether for starting it. And that was where it was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the face of all of that, I said, "I think I'll try it." Now that will be 20 years next April. It was 19 years last April. And I've been trying it one day at a time ever since, thank you very much, and it's been working beautifully. And I would like to tell you some about what's happened since then. I joined a group and I had moved from the furnace room over to Huntington. And I joined a group near Huntington called Northport. And in Northport they had step meetings, and they introduced me to the steps very early. My sponsor came around one Saturday morning and brought me a gift of the 12 and 12. I know in this country you study the big book a lot. I was given that to read, but we studied the 12 and 12. And I was told that I was to read the step before I went to the meeting and that I should read it again when I came home from the meeting, because they had step meetings then in the 60s in Northport. And I was told that if I did this, that I would find that the gremlins had been on the bookshelf, because I would find more in the text, having discussed it at the meeting, than I had been able to find reading it before I went. And I did this over and over in many sequences of step meetings in Northport, and they are the basis of my sobriety. I took the first step within a short space of time, because all the problems that I had when I came to AA disappeared within 3 months or a year. And I found that I had a whole new set. The new set of problems that I had were what was really wrong with this alcoholic in the first place. And I was told that if I learned steps and used them in my life, that I would find a way to live in which I didn't have to drink. And that I would find happiness and contentment beyond my wildest dreams. And it has come to pass. There is no doubt in my mind that it has come to pass. When I got to the second step, they told me that if I would come to believe and do as they did in the power that is demonstrated in this fellowship, that I would be free of the fear that I had suffered from all of my life. And I am free of the fear that made me unable to play the piano in a concert when I was a kid, that made me unable to lead the meetings in the Junior Women's Club. I was freed of that fear that I had of being approved of or disapproved of through the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then in the third step, they taught me to turn my life and my will over to a power outside myself. I do that every day. Many days I do it over and over and over again, because I'm a willful alcoholic who takes that will back over and over and over again. And in direct proportion to my discomfort have I taken that will back. But I know and believe in my heart
But as long as I will remake that decision and turn my will back to God, that God's will for me is far better than my will for me ever could be. I then began to work the fourth through the ninth step, which to me are the workshop of AA, where we work on our defective character, where we learn to understand the meaning of each resentment. What is the meaning of what seems to be in this resentment that I may get? And I get them. I still get them. I think I'll get them until the day I die. I also give them. And I have to understand that too. And the eighth step tells me that I have to, you know, be willing to make amends to anybody to whom I've given resentment. I'm not a person, and I never was, drunk or sober, who doesn't do much. I have a tendency to get involved, too involved. And this has to do with the ego thing we were talking about, and it is the area of my character that I am re-looking at in this stage of sobriety. I find myself critical of some long-time members of AA when I see their egos. And like I was taught from the very beginning in Northport, when I point a finger, there are three pointing back. And if there's something in your character that particularly disturbs me, I better look in and find out why it particularly disturbs me. And then the first step, I went and I shared with my sponsor everything I learned that first time I took the fourth step in Northport. And I told her the major things that I had learned was that pride was the father of all my defects and that I had no ability to love. And she said to me, if you really mean that, and you really know that, you have a chance for a happy life. She said, because if you don't know that you can't love, you'll never learn how. But if you know that you have no ability to love, you stand a chance of learning how. And today, because I've continued these steps, and I've continued to go to meetings and to listen at meetings, have I learned a little bit of how to be loved. And I'd always practice it. And I used the 10th step. I used the 10th step to try and bring myself back in harness when I get away from it. And so it went. I was sober about 7 years. And life had gotten really nice. I no longer was in the attic apartment. I had a garden apartment in one of these places with the early penal architecture, you know. And I had wall-to-wall carpeting, and I had gotten a really good job again in a community nearby. I had a new Chevrolet. I was the epitome of middle-class living. I was respected in the community. I was asked to speak at group anniversaries. You know what that means. And I was very proud of myself. And there was one thing missing. And I became enamored of this gentleman in the group. He also became enamored of me, and the problem was that his wife didn't like it. And you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think we are the only place where people experience puberty and menopause simultaneously. It happens. This gentleman was one of those people who were, quote, in the process of getting a divorce. I always say that's all one word, you know. Some of us have been there. And I misused what I believed was my ability, my newfound ability to love. And I did love, and I am not sorry for that. I am sorry for any pain that may have been caused as a result of that. But it was the greatest growing experience of my sobriety, because the pain I experienced as a result of getting that far away from God's will for me was the pain that brought me. What is the meaning of any kind of suffering? I'm beginning to learn. It was the most suffering I ever remember, drunk or sober. You know, you don't suffer much when you're drunk. Because you can always have another drink and soften the edges. But I couldn't. I had made a full commitment to staying away from the first drink. And I couldn't. And I cried and wailed and screamed. And I had one thing going for me. I had some very good habits. AA habits. And if you're new in AA, I want to tell you something. The first year of sobriety is to make habits, like picking up the phone every day. Just do it. And don't try to understand why, because when the chips are down, you'll pick up the phone, not the drink. And it worked for me. The willingness in those first years of doing what they told me to worked for me when I got into the darkness again, because I was in the darkness. I had gotten in charge of my life again. And I got into this relationship. I still have to write him a thank you note, because it pushed me into the 11th step. I had gotten into psychotherapy, which helped me enormously. I have to say this. Because when I got to the 6th step, there was a lot I didn't understand about my life, myself, and my character. And I became willing to put the time, effort, and money into psychotherapy to help me. And the ability to stick with that I had gained here in AA. And I saw my therapy as an exercise in the 6th step. And I made some changes in my work habits and my whole lifestyle that were very good as a result of the psychotherapy. I graduated from that. I've returned to a different kind of therapy today, which is more spiritual. But I did then what I needed to do. And the reason I'm sharing this is to say simply that the AA program is my diagram for living, but it doesn't eliminate asking for help with anything else. I may have to go to the Mayo Clinic for an operation on my feet. And in fact, this weekend I'm trying to put myself in a frame of mind to accept that idea. I want them to guarantee me that it's going to be all better if I have the operation and I experience the pain and I take a couple of months out. And they won't do that, can you imagine? And I am trying to gather that courage, you see. But I can't get my feet fixed in AA. I have to find in AA the courage to do what I have to do. And I experience the going to psychotherapy as having the courage to do what I have to do. And so, when I went through this pain, it was after I had left therapy, and I had moved into New York, having lost a job on Long Island during the aircraft crash in the early 70s. And moved into New York, and I was stripped again. I wore my props. But they were AA meetings in New York. Oh, they weren't asking me to speak at their group anniversaries, you know. And they didn't think I was any big shot or anything like that. But they were AA meetings, and they read the preamble, and they talked about the steps. And I went there, and I opened my mouth, and I started to cry, and they thought I was a newcomer, and I was in business. But they gave me the help that I needed. And I worked on prayer and meditation, and I established a conscious contact with my higher power, which is very difficult to talk about, I think, for each of us. I love the book that we have at BSO called Paint to Believe, because it is individual spiritual experiences. Mine came through the study of some books by Emmett Fox, Sermon on the Mount, Power Through Constructive Thinking, his meditation on the 23rd Psalm. I experienced the connection with a power outside myself that saw me through that pain. And it was the most interesting phenomenon, because I had moved from Long Island, where I had a car, to New York, where nobody can afford a car. And I would have to carry my groceries in one of these carts with squeaky wheels up Murray Hill. And I would be crying at the indignity of this. Of course, all the New Yorkers do this, you see. I mean, it's just a part of the lifestyle. But I would be crying. Now, within, it seemed like suddenly I'd be sane carrying that car. My consciousness changed because I got in touch with a higher power. The things that I hated, I began to love, because I again loved being alive, and I came into one with sobriety again. And that was the benefit of that experience. It was at that time that I fully took the 3rd step. I had this silly job with the American Kennel Club that was keeping me even. I had a lot of good AA friends. And I said, God, I'll go and write those silly baby letters again today, but I know it's not your will for me for the rest of my life. And I know that you will reveal your will for me as long as I stay on this path. And what happened was, to make a long story short, I was offered the job at the General Service Office. and all the natural tendency that I had to work in organizations, for organizations, was put to use. Everything I had ever done in my business life, and in my social life, and in my home life, was put to use in this job. I have been there 11 years. It's been the most wonderful 11 years of my life. The relationships that I have formed in that period of time with men and women, with the people I've worked with, are wonderful, loving relationships. When I was a child, I sat at my grandmother's knee, and she used to tell me stories about Ireland. And I always wanted to go to Ireland. And I said, well, I'll never be able to afford to, you know, spend money on Ireland. I can barely get to the Poconos, you know, on vacation. Well, in 1974, the World Service Meeting was held in England, the Third World Service Meeting. And Monita New, who's now retired, was a coordinator. And she asked if I could assist her and go with her. She was then well into her 60s. And she needed some help. And so I was sent to London with Juanita Niles, who raised Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And the three of us staffed that meeting. And I had my trip to Ireland that I long, long dreamed of. And I was invited. I went into Dublin and I went to the General Service Office and visited the AAs there. And I went to St. John of God's Hospital where the AA meetings were held. And I spent an evening in the home of one of the actors in the Abbey Theater. He was a member. And we celebrated the anniversary of a Finnish man who had been at the World Service Meeting there that night. I've had many, many wonderful, wonderful experiences in this period of time. I've met many wonderful people, John and Joe, the delegates you've sent year after year to the General Service Conference. I've traveled all over the United States and Canada. And I can tell you that I'm a happy woman today. But the one thing I know is that I must continue to work these steps. I go to AA meetings in New York, and there aren't very many people who have more than 10 years sobriety. And I must know and learn that people with a lot less sobriety than me can teach me. I must work daily on my ego. I must work daily on being a loving person. These are the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, and the truth that I learned here is the freedom to be what I was supposed to be in the first place. And you make that possible for me each day, and for that I thank you very, very much. Thank you.